Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Jerry Bologna, president and CEO of JEDCO, an amazing announcement today, and he's here to tell us about it. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Newell. Good afternoon.
So the council passed on some things in June, and y'all announced, I think, this morning, the creation of a new district. Tell us about this district.
So this is the what we announced this morning was the establishment of the Jefferson Parish Design District, and major cities all over the country and really throughout the world have these design districts, whether it's L.A. or Vegas or Miami or New York. But there was no true design district in this region. And so this is about a 320-acre area, basically from the parish line of Jefferson Highway when you cross into Jefferson all the way to the bend. So Monticello to Brooklyn and from the river to Earhart. And what's exciting about this is, you know, most efforts that JEDCO undertakes, we have to start from scratch. And this is an effort that's really grew organically. And there are a number of design-related businesses there, whether it's the big box retailers like Lowe's, the Salvation Army thrift store, but you have a dozen or so design professionals and flooring companies and everything you would need related to design already exist in that area. So we were approached by some of those designers about establishing the design district, and here we are today announcing that district.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but within that same area, there is the availability of land for development as well, right?
There is land available. There's warehousing, retail space available. So lots of room for future development, and that's what's exciting about the design district. We have the existing anchors there, but we want to attract more design-related firms to the area. And through the council action, we've established the district boundaries. Design-related firms and other investment in the area really can qualify for some tax incentives. We have finance programs at JEDCO that are geared towards design-related firms. And so we not only want to attract more design-related businesses to the area, which is really a placemaking and a place-based development strategy, but we want everyone in the region to know this as the design district. So whenever they have a need for those services, they know they're coming right there to the Jefferson Design District.
This becomes an attractive place to locate oneself within that silo for sure, because it's been, and I don't mean this as a criticism, but it's kind of been a very much a mixed bag in that area for a long time, right?
It's an interesting area because you have some residential pockets interspersed with some heavy industrial. And this is what we've seen over the years is just some organic growth of more office space, more retail trades. And I think you'll see a further development of that area into higher and better uses. And that's not to say industrial uses aren't the highest and best use in areas, but we want to really have this as a front door to Jefferson Parish. As people come in from the city, we want to put our best foot forward.
Some of the existing businesses that are there, Acme Locks, Amon and Associates, Araliga Custom Millwork, B&B Flooring, and Budget Blinds, all Dop Antiques, Famiglio's Ironworks, very familiar with those folks, Haven Custom Furnishings, and the list goes on and on. These are the type of businesses that you typically find in these design districts?
Yeah, absolutely. My wife and I were in San Diego earlier, last month, and toured one of the design districts in that area. And you see all sorts of businesses, and what it becomes is just a magnet. If you're building a house, designing, renovating, building, you know, commercial buildings, these are places you can go to get, whether it's your building appliances, flooring, everything, all in one stop.
Yeah. What are you hearing from the existing businesses there? I guess the tide rises for all, even though they may have competitors to them moving in that same area.
Yeah. So interesting you mentioned that, because one of the brains behind this effort was Karen Nelson, who owns, along with her business partner, the Design Center of New Orleans. And she was telling me this morning how many of her friends in the industry, other designers, now want to locate. They want to be with their peers. They want to be in an area where people recognize it as a design district. So it really is that making that pie bigger instead of carving it up into more pieces. It's creating a bigger pie.
Historically, some of these types of businesses have been located in Elmwood, right?
I think you had them interspersed all over the city, some of them downtown, other areas of the city throughout Jefferson.
In Mid-City, Mid-City as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
And this is really an opportunity to bring those all here. You know, it's a really strategic piece of land, because it's easy to get anywhere from there, really, to get into the city, to even to get on the Earhart Expressway, to get to the interstate. It works fairly easy.
It's great proximity, not only ingress and egress to the city, but you're right there near one of the state's largest employers, employment bases in Ochsner. There's public transportation on the corridor. So it really, that stretch of Jefferson Highway is really poised for a facelift, and this is the type of thing that is one of those grassroots efforts that can help people invest in their buildings and invest in their properties and attract more and more uses. And I think as the district becomes successful, then you're going to have more desire for quality of life offerings, more restaurants and other offerings that are going to want to be there as well.
Yeah, no doubt. Last question, Jerry. There was an an oil production facility back there. I can't remember if it was Shell or the other or another.
That was the Equilon, Shell Equilon plant.
What's going on with that piece of land? Huge piece of land.
Yeah, that if you're facing the Lowe's home improvement, that's to the left of it. And I really, Newell, I have to be honest, I have to check into that. I know there were some remediation efforts to clean up that property and get it back into commerce, but I would have to get an update on that.
I mean, incredible opportunity, though. I mean, that's as big a piece of land as we have on the East Bank that's probably available for development, right?
It's a very large tract that goes from Jefferson all the way back to Earhart Expressway. Yeah, it would be prime for development.
And is there still were plans for the coal storage extension road to go to Jeff Highway? Is that still being bannered about, or is that project dead? Do you know?
So Dakin Street, which is one of the streets that runs perpendicular Jefferson Highway, there was talk, a significant talk at one time, to have that go under the Earhart Expressway and connect Airline to Jefferson Highway. It was put on the back burner for funding reasons. I still think it exists on the back burner, but there hasn't been any movement to push that right now.
I mean, that would be a huge addition to this district, right?
Absolutely. You don't have much north-south. You have great east-west traffic flow, but not much north-south, and I think that's important not only to this district, but emergency vehicles going to and from the hospital and just greater flow of traffic throughout the region.
Yeah, for sure. Well, congratulations on the creation of the Jefferson Parish Design District. 320 acres located in Old Jefferson. That's exciting to hear about it. And congrats again, Jerry Bologna, President and CEO of JEDCO. And thank you so much for joining us. Have a great week.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That's Jerry Bologna, President and CEO of the Jefferson Economic Development Corporation. They're involved in a whole lot of different projects, very similar to GNO Inc. And when we talked to Michael Heck, they work together a lot, and they do a lot of the same things in Jefferson Parish, and we're excited for this new project. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Folks, there was a recent article in the New York Times that talked about that nearly half of all murderers, those that are committing murder, get away with it in this country. It's a flip of a coin as to whether or not they're going to be arrested. And when we compare ourselves to our peer countries around the world, we find that we fall far behind in the clearance rates. Joining us to talk about this topic is Ronald Surpass, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola and former NOPD chief. Ronnie, welcome to the show.
Hey, Noel, how are you? It's good to be with you today.
Doing well, Ronnie. I was surprised to read this article, actually, in the New York Times. It's not a conservative rag by any stretch of the imagination. It's something that you and I have been talking about for a long time here. You know, human capital matters, technology matters, and the list goes on and on. Your reaction to this New York Times article?
Well, it's like most media articles. They don't have enough words available in their article to talk about really the depth of the issue. From about 2004 to 2019, the murder clearance rate, which means someone was arrested or someone who could have been arrested was not able to, often because they've expired or they're in a prison. That's the measure that the FBI uses. From 2004 to 2019, it was steady in the nation around 60 to 66% year in and year out. Obviously, it took a drop during COVID, but in the last couple of years, when it dropped to the 50s with COVID, it's starting to move back up again. Now, that helps the listeners have a general feel, but Newell, something you and I used to talk about on the radio when we was working continues to be the case. Solid academic research and solid governmental data tells us that when all the things that can be known about a murder are known, 70 to 80% of the victims knew or had some relationship with the person who killed them. So when people say that murders are not being cleared higher than, let's say, to meet that 70 or 80%, and this is where you and I, our experience would help people, it's often because everybody knows who did it, but nobody's talking. Nobody wants to cooperate for whatever reasons, or they're afraid to cooperate. So during your time as sheriff and my time as chief, we started relying more on Crime Stoppers so we could get information from people who were afraid to talk for their own life. We started relying more on the incredible intelligence center that you created in JP that we partnered with you. We're relying more now on video technology, on digital forensics of phones and infotainment system of cars. But the real problem there in our communities, and when people like to compare us to other nations, is that research and the data indicate 70 to 80% of murder victims had some relationship with their victim. And somehow or another, those relationships are not coming to the government to solve the murder of that person.
Yeah, the other thing that the article points out, when, you know, in my thought process, when you have these relational murders like that, it's not a question of if so much of when, right? There's a conflict, and the conflict's going to get resolved, and it's not going to be through some conflict resolution technique. It's going to be what they know how to do on the street. So whether you put a gun in the hand of the perpetrator or a knife or some other instrumentality, I'm not necessarily sure that it would matter here in this country. They try to make a case it's because of access to guns. Maybe, but
that's crazy.
I'm not completely convinced by that at all. Your thoughts?
No, I'm not convinced by that either, and I only have 45 years of experience, and you, believe it or not, I think getting close to 50 years of experience. People who use guns to kill people generally don't care about the law anyway. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think so.
Oh, I hit you with the 50, bro? Oh, I'm sorry.
With the 50, bro. Yeah.
You think people didn't know?
But no, you're right.
My real experience is clear. People who have moments of lost control and kill someone are very rare compared to the ones where people were searching for the victim they wanted to kill. And as a result, those people don't care about the law of guns. They got a gun. They're going to kill the person they're looking for. And that eats up a tremendous number of the raw number of cases. When you get outside of the cities of 500,000, here's another thing, Noah. When you look at the data, cities over 500,000 have always had a lower clearance rate than cities under 500,000 and lower than cities that are a quarter of a million. And that's because those cities are smaller, the relationships are tighter and closer, and they tend not to be. And I know a lot of people might not want to hear this, and I know you would agree with me. In these smaller cities, you're not seeing as much of this gang turf warfare, group warfare, where I'm going to kill so-and-so because I saw him on Bourbon Street. I shot him in Baton Rouge. The guy survived. Now I'm going to shoot him on Bourbon Street, and I'm going to hit 10, 12 other people in the crowd when I shoot at him. That generally doesn't happen in cities that are much smaller than the urban centers.
No, no doubt. I mean, and, you know, and it's not even really what we would think about the traditional organized gang. A lot of these are just loosely connected relationships that are had out there. But what it does do is drive the emotion, right? When you have three knuckleheads together as opposed to just one.
Absolutely. And yet they're also driven by no fear for who else they hurt. Now, here's something else that I think can sometimes agitate people who think it's about guns. When you and I were young cops a half a decade ago, if somebody was killed, it was one gun, one bullet, no mistakes. Today, and in the last 10, 12 years, because of the dynamics of groups and gangs and the unintended fear, they have no fear of shooting into a crowd of people. You see funerals where somebody's mad at somebody in the funeral, and they'll shoot 10, 12 people in the funeral trying to hit one guy. That's the difference. 50 years ago, I'm mad at Newell. I got a gun. I got one bullet, and he's going to be the only person shot. That these groups don't think like that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting.
They don't care
we always
who else they shoot.
In the Times, there's always articles about over-incarceration, right? And that's what kind of moved me about this article. This was kind of a different approach where they said the lack of legal accountability emboldens criminals, leading to more crime and violence. You and I use the word selective incapacitation, the impact criminals getting them off the street and putting them in jail. We always compare our incarceration rates to these peer countries as well. And I'm always amused by the fact that we offend at a higher rate than they do in those countries. So why wouldn't they think we'd have more people in jail, even with our what is a pretty abysmal solution rate on many of these crimes?
Well, I think that, and I'm sure to incite anger by some audience members, if you compare one country to another country, that's not particularly methodologically sound. There's
right.
dramatic differences in cultures and societies and economies and single-family homes, single-family parents who aren't 18 yet. A lot of that doesn't replicate in these other countries that certain factions want to say, oh, if we were only like them. Well, here's one for you. If you look at the rate in which people are stabbed in the United Kingdom, it's pretty damn scary. We don't have a lot of stabbings in this country, so that would be a crazy comparison. Because you really are comparing Maseratis and Volkswagens. There are two completely different notions. So I get a little bit agitated when these do-gooders who say, if we only had the crime rate of Sweden, well, maybe Sweden doesn't have as much single-family homes or the destruction of the nuclear family we have. Maybe Sweden doesn't have this, and maybe we don't have what they have. So quit trying to compare them. They don't have a Second Amendment in Sweden. Get over it. Just get over it. It is what it is.
So when we talk about, and I know that you interact with a lot of folks that are still in the business on a daily basis, what are you hearing from them? I mean, you know, one of the observations in the article, it says, why does America solve so few crimes? And it says that experts point to five explanations. A lack of attention and resources. That, you know, we've spent more time on enhanced sentencing as opposed to giving other resources more in line with solving the crime.
I think you and I would agree, as practitioners, as in human beings, when an individual makes a mistake, we want to give them a break. But it's a foolhardy task to think that people who are committing these gangland-style murders in America, they woke up that day and said, I'm going to commit my first crime ever today, and I'm going to kill somebody and shoot four or five other people in the process because they were in the way. It's just nonsensical. When people are in this stage of their life, be it good, bad, or indifferent, they have lost touch with social norms and social rules. It's one of the reasons, if you remember the call-in sessions that we were all doing and I think had a lot of good outcomes, but they could not have perfect outcomes because the time you're talking to a 22-year-old person who's been in and out of the CJ system, who doesn't have a nuclear family, who has no idea who his real family is bombed out of the education system, is bombed out of the economy, they're generally not going to change too much because they can't. That's not the same as a 17-year-old kid who steals a car one time and says, my God, I'll never do it again as long as I live. And that's why they conflate these issues, because by conflating them, it confuses the casual listener to say, oh, my goodness, why aren't we giving people chances? You and I know a half a decade versus 45 years, a half a century, that people who are shooting people have been in a lot of trouble in their life, unless it's a intimate personal violence thing, which is very sad. Wouldn't you agree? People who are shooting each other on the streets in Harvey and East New Orleans have been in a lot of trouble and have refused the assistance of the criminal justice system.
Well, we have generational crime families, too. I mean, they've been involved.
What's the name of the one on Simon Bolivar?
Yeah, I mean, they've been involved for years and years and years. I mean, and, you know, it hasn't changed. You've used the term nuclear family a lot, and that is one of the primary differences. I was just in Croatia, and I was curious because there's, like, no crime there. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. And I was talking to a driver that we had, and I said, what do you think is the one issue about that, why that's not the case here? And he goes, we don't want to bring disrespect on our family.
That's right. Could you tell me how you asked him that in Croatian?
Not very well, but thankfully he spoke fluent English. But you know what's interesting? You know, he said, here we live together still. So he's like in his 30s, he's married, he has two children, he lives on the third floor of the family, you know, structure. His parents live on the first floor, and his brother lives on the second floor with her spouse and their children. They have meals every night together, you know, and he goes, we would never bring, a situation where we would embarrass our family because it's all about family. And interesting there, also, no property taxes, right? Because they want the property to remain in the family line. And they don't want home ownership to be a burden there. Very much in tune to cultivating the strong family. And it works. Ronnie, I was there 15 days, saw two policemen.
I mean, oh, my goodness.
Just two. That was it. Traveled to 15 different cities and saw two policemen the whole time I was there. I mean, it was like, you know, you and I, we walk around and we're looking for these things, right, instead of just relaxing. But that's all there was.
Well, remember, we looked for police so hard we had to put yellow vests on them so we could see them.
Yeah. But, you know, and we wonder, you know, why we have these differences. And it's pretty easy. It's pretty clear. You know, I just got a text. It's the same way in Italy. Yes, it is. I mean, I was in Italy. I saw more policemen in Italy, but not that many. You know.
Well, and they try to make the argument. Some people will try to make the argument and turn it into a racial argument because it inflames people's passions. Put it all aside. In our careers, I have seen white families that have fallen apart and black families that have fallen apart. It didn't matter what the race was. It mattered that the family fell apart, that the children didn't have stable influences. There's a lot of criminological theory about why crime happens, but people like myself in this particular field, I like to study the theories about why crime does not happen, control theories. And they're all based upon families and communities raising children to have commitments and expectations and determination. So at the end of the day, it's not about race. It doesn't matter whether it's black or white. If you got kids who are being able to tell their mom and them that they're going out to start their day at midnight, it ain't a good thing. And as Chuck Ramsey, a good friend of mine, said all the time, if you're waiting for the government to raise your children, that ain't going to go well. It's true. No. It's just truisms.
Well, I mean, how many other things do they do well? Not many, but, you know. So when we talk about resource allocation, let's bring it back to resource allocation. Do you, in what you're hearing today from leaders in law enforcement, is the tide starting to turn where they really want to make these investments in technologies that are going to really help catch the bad guys?
Yeah, absolutely. And the consultancy work we do in departments, the biggest departments in the country and the smallest departments, it is always going to be if technology can make us more efficient to serve the public, we should do it. And yes, you see in tremendous investments in digital forensics units. You see in huge investments in clearing up DNA backlogs. But those all cause work, right? I'm not saying they don't stop work. They create work. We're seeing more and more use. Oh, speaking about why don't we be like other countries? Well, other countries in the world use facial recognition to solve crimes and make people safe. We're still having a political debate over it here in this country. So, yes. And I also think we're starting to see a little bit of a treading water on the larger departments in the country being able to at least stop much of the attrition loss and kind of hold even. The good news is they're kind of holding even now. The bad news is they're still significantly shorter than they were. And the final point to your question is a resource allocation. When you were sheriff and I was chief, we're going to solve murders. And we're going to put on it whatever we can to get that done. And we're going to solve sexual assault. And we're going to put everything on it to get it done. But as governments begin to suck out the resources of policing, you end up creating the dynamic where the community gets very disenchanted with you because you're not coming to the car burglars anymore. You're not coming to the bicycle theft, which in 90% of the citizens, that's the biggest crime they'll ever have in their life. And because of the staffing division decisions, good or bad, the citizens start to feel very disenfranchised from the police department, like, well, my crime was important to me, so it's a bit of a circle that we're still seeing around the country. If you ever hear somebody say they're going to do call mitigation in 911 centers, what that really means is we're going to tell people we're coming to less of what you ask us about, and that separates us in a way that doesn't help.
Yeah, I don't know that you could ever restore or maintain public trust and confidence by call mitigation strategies.
You're right.
Always said that the hallmark of the success of the JPSO was response time to all crimes. It didn't matter. Because the vast majority of people will never interact with police. But if it is an interaction, it's typically going to be calling 911 because somebody's pulling door handles, stealing bikes, criminal damage or otherwise. And when they call, they want you there, plain and simple.
Absolutely. And, you know, we used to hear a little bit a couple years ago that, you know, these kids running around breaking people's car windows, that's not such a big deal. I think the mayor might have said that, just throwing it out there. And the problem with that is if somebody breaks your car window, you lose a day of work because you got to go to SafeLight and get your window replaced. It's not just simply the acts of juvenile truants, but the issue there for me and you is that now you've made sure a citizen doesn't think you care about what happened to them. And they're the ones paying the freight, and that's a bad place to be. And luckily, and good for reason, the NOPD's Citizen Satisfaction Survey done independently by the Crime Coalition is starting to get some better connectivity between the community and the police, and that's great. Sheriffs, and you and I've talked about this a lot, even over alcoholic beverages, sheriffs have to have a more in-tuned relationship to that kind of data because it's part and parcel to how they make sure they're serving. And police chiefs do it, but they have to do it through the prism of some other political process that might not see it as important. Fortunately, in Nashville, both of the mayors I worked for and the governor I worked for in Washington, they believed in that survey data. They said, man, this helps us do it. So you're right. You've got to make sure people are happy, or they're going to tell their friends not to cooperate.
We talked briefly about across the pond and how they police there. My perspective, and I know you have more recent interaction with folks, are we anywhere close to like their camera technology that they utilize, separate and apart from facial recognition, just cameras itself? It seems as though 20 years ago, 25 years ago, they started with CCTV everywhere, like in England, and it moved to other European countries. And we seem to be way behind the eight ball in comparison with them. Is that still kind of the case?
I think we closed the gap some, because the real-time crime centers that have been popping up all over America, I visited one a couple weeks ago in Fairfax County, Virginia. Fairfax County, Virginia is a community of over 1 million people, and they have a real-time crime center that's probably one of the best I've seen in the country. And they are able to jump into public cameras. They're able to jump into business cameras. They have citizens who turn over their address of their camera, not their camera video, but their address, so the police can go knock on doors. We were doing that in New Orleans even. I think we're getting better at it. And I guess one of the differences is, and except for maybe, you know, like New York and Chicago and maybe other places I'm not that familiar with, we don't have the infrastructure of public transportation like England does. So in a way, it would be easier for them to start stringing up a bunch of cameras, whereas we don't really have as much of that in cities outside of maybe New York or Chicago. But to your question, yes, the real-time crime centers that are popping up in departments of all size, they're taking better access to that information and using it.
Yeah.
Not nearly to the extent they do over there. I agree with you.
Yeah. One of the other things, and I don't
Unless
think most
at the
people...
Capitol, remember, they use facial recognition to identify people at the Capitol on January 6th. And you got some cities that are still saying you can't use facial recognition. And, no, you and I have talked about this, and you're a lawyer. Please remind the audience, facial recognition is like a fingerprint. It's like DNA. It just says who you might be. You don't get a charge for your face like that. You don't get a charge.
No,
and,
it's just
and the
part
politicization
of
this, even in New Orleans, they're still politicizing this, right? What magistrate would sign a warrant with only a facial recognition or only a fingerprint? Nobody. Nobody.
Well, we would hope nobody, but there have been instances where, you know, we have people that just, they don't stay abreast of technology, how it interacts with the law, what it means. You know, we view these jobs as being mailbox money. You know, we just show up to pick up the check, you know, and you got to work hard every day. Every day is an opportunity to learn, you know, and if you're not learning something every day, then you're less than. And if you're the leader of the organization, your organization is going to be less than. Right. I mean, we all know that. Go ahead. Ryan,
well,
and
back to the point, yeah, we're back to what we were just saying just a few seconds ago. The public watches this, and if they don't think you're keeping up and if they don't think you're doing the best you can to help them, they turn off. And when they turn off, a lot of things can go bad.
No, there's no doubt about that. Worthwhile reading, I think. It's entitled Nearly Half of America's Murderers Get Away With It. New York Times article. German Lopez is the author. It was published on July the 6th. Thank you so much, Ronald Serpas, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, for joining us today. Really appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great week, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Open Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. So we now have folks that are going out and shooting U.S. Customs and Border employees at facilities, most recently in McAllen, Texas. There's been a series of articles written about, you know, members of Congress going and getting in the face of these Border Patrol and immigration officers at detention facilities around the country. And then we wonder why we got the crazies that are running around. It starts with one group of crazies, and then it moves to another group of crazies. And if you don't think these things are connected, you're a fool, quite frankly. Leaders of Congress going on, getting in the face of law enforcement officers, trying to work their way into secure facilities, all under the auspices of some silly authority that they think they have as members of Congress, and that they get to do it when they want, why they want, and how they want, rings hollow. It's a joke. But for many, they don't understand. They've embraced this conduct. Hopefully it comes to an end. People are going to get seriously hurt, and they have already. And then they cry on the floor of the Senate about being put on the ground, placed on their chest, handcuffed for their crazy behavior. And here we are. And hopefully these ambushes don't continue. Because that's kind of what the members of Congress have done. They just show up, kind of ambush somebody that's working out at the front gate, trying to make their way into it, into the facility. For what reason? It's a secure facility. You don't, it's not how that works. It doesn't work that way for anybody. As a sheriff, I didn't take the liberties to just show up and walk into the jail. I called to let them know that I was coming. I went through the process like everyone else. I go to federal court, I go through the process like everybody else. I go to state court, I go through the process like everybody else at that point in time. I don't know what these members of Congress thought that they were doing, and they know about copycats. They've seen it all around. They get nervous if they are going to be the target. But somehow there's a disconnect when it's others. I simply don't buy it. And neither should you. We'll be right back. We'll check in with Scoot when we return. Stay with us. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, we have a few things to talk about before 3 o'clock. But at 3 o'clock, Congressman Steve Scalise joins me live in the studio. And there'll be a lot to talk about. So I'm looking forward to that.
All righty, stay tuned. Scoot's up next. Headed your way, folks. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Tuesday evening.